Welcome to Security Squad, a CertSecurity.com podcast for April 25th, 2012. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rob Westervelt. In the studio is Eric Parizeau. Eric is senior site editor of CertSecurity.com and all of the websites associated with. How you doing, Eric?
Hi, Rob. Good, thanks.
And Mike Momoso is in the studio. Mike is editorial director of the Security Media Group here. How you doing, Mike?
I'm good, Rob.
We've got a lot to talk about. It's been a while since our last Security Squad. And there have been a lot of interesting events that have taken place over the last month or so. One being the 2012 Verizon Data Breach Investigations Report. There were 855 breaches that were looked at or analyzed in this report, and 174 million stolen records. It wasn't just U.S.-based records, we should say. It's not just the Secret Service and Verizon, but there were cases from the Dutch National Tech Crime Unit, police forces from Australia, Ireland, and London. So it was an interesting mix of data breach cases that were investigated by forensics teams in these various locales. Hacktivism was the big theme that seemed to come out of the report. That's kind of leading to my first question. Successful breaches carried out in the name of Anonymous and other splinter groups accounted for 100 million records, and that's almost 60% of all stolen data out of these 855 breaches. But activist groups accounted for only 3% of the 2011 breaches analyzed in the report. So, Eric, are we paying too much attention to hacktivist groups here, or you know, have they really made a major impact on data breaches in 2011?
Yes and yes. I've made the case in the past for paying attention to hacktivists and making sure, as an enterprise, your organization is aware of the interest groups that may want to do it harm. But in this case, I think it's more of a label than anything else. I mean, you could certainly spin the data in a variety of different ways and say, you know, these types of groups cause this much damage or whatever. But to me, it's more about the methods in which the breaches are taking place versus saying that, you know, making a classification about a certain number of the actors involved.
You know, I heard a presentation from Josh Corman, who has been investigating Anonymous, or at least trying to put a face on Anonymous. It's been very difficult for them. He seems to say that you can actually see that some of these breaches, even though the hacker comes out and says that it's, you know, from Anonymous, it may have maybe kind of a cover story. It may not really be Anonymous behind these attacks.
Oh, sure. I mean, I don't think there's any way to really say who was behind some of these attacks.
It's very easy for somebody just to use that as a guise.
Right, right, exactly. And if you are a wannabe hacktivist, what's the easiest and quickest way to get notoriety for your work? It's to call your, you know, associate yourself with Anonymous. And I think that's, especially now that the mainstream media has caught on to Anonymous. And you know, there have been a lot of arrests now, so I think maybe the trend has already gone by. But that was certainly something we saw in the, you know, last year, even the last 6 months or so, where, you know, it seems like every week there was an attack by Anonymous or someone associated with it. But yeah, interesting to see if that'll go away or not.
It's unfortunate that they don't say, or they don't kind of paint a picture of how many breaches Anonymous or a splinter group were involved with out of these 855 breaches. They could do it without naming the company. That would give us a better picture of, you know, was there one breach here that resulted in hundreds of millions of, or hundreds of thousands of records that kind of skewed the results here of the DBIR?
Yeah, I mean, I caught the end of, well, most of Josh's presentation last week that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And I think the point he made, too, is that Anonymous isn't really this kind of central organization kind of thing. There are a lot of splinter groups, a lot of folks that try to attach themselves with that label. I think the bottom line with the DBIR point, too, is that these attacks aren't very sophisticated, that these hacktivists are pulling off, and at the end of the day, they're hackers, they're criminals, and to kind of lump them as something separate you know, it maybe isn't exactly doing it justice. You know, these guys are, they're pulling off basic denial of service attacks and SQL injection and stuff like that, that someone with a, you know, a base level of expertise could pull off.
That's right. 79% of the attacks represented in the report were opportunistic. 96% were not highly difficult. So that goes right into what you're saying.
So to Eric's point, I think it's important that if, you know, you're an oil company or somebody that, you know, might tick off somebody with a political or social agenda, yeah, you need to be aware. But at the end of the day, you've got to have your basic security in place. And that's what it comes down to. I mean, a weak or vulnerable web application is a weak or vulnerable web application, no matter who's attacking it. And, you know, I don't know. I think the DBIR kind of went for a splash hyping up the hacktivist angle because, it, you know, this stuff isn't very sophisticated, these attacks. And they do a good job detailing that, too, in the report.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk, unless, Eric, you have anything else to say about hacktivists.
Only point is I was, like Mike, surprised to see such an emphasis on hacktivism, but I think it does help to legitimize hacktivism and the need for enterprises to look at it more closely, as well as I think it was Verizon's way of pointing out that we're talking about low-hanging fruit in most cases.
Yeah, and you know, you just reminded me of another question I should ask Mike. We had a discussion about know your in a previous squad about knowing who your adversary is. Do CISOs need to take any different approach to what they're doing as a result of hacktivism?
Yes and no. I mean, I think if there's a particular attack that's going around that a certain group or a certain that is targeting a particular vulnerability or something like that, then yeah, you need to pay attention to it. But it doesn't dismiss the need for a baseline of defense in depth.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that in a moment. Some of the security basics.
I mean, if you look at the rest of the DBIR, the sophistication, if there's any, is in the automated attacks on smaller companies.
Yeah.
That's where you saw a lot of automation, and that's where you saw a lot of, a lot of records being scooped up in attacks like that against organizations that really aren't prepared to defend themselves.
Mm-hmm. We are going to get to some of the recommendations in the DBIR, which seem to be ignored to a certain extent. We'll get to that. I wanted to talk about the kind of information being stolen. Half of the, about 48%, about half of the breaches were payment card information. And 42% of breaches made up authentication credentials. And I know not just in the DBIR, but in TrustWave's report that looks just at U.S., or I believe it's just U.S., data breach investigations that they've conducted with their forensics teams, as well as the Microsoft Security Intelligence Report that's been coming out year after year. It's due out soon. It talks about account credentials being king. Can we take anything from the kind of data, Eric, that's being stolen? Payment card data is down to roughly half of all of these 855 breaches, and it seems like account credentials seem to be growing in value to these attackers.
Well, we follow it closely, so I don't know if I see any great surprises there. I think it only emphasizes what we already know. To a certain extent, you're going to see some fluctuation from year to year just based on the number of breaches, which tends to, you know, there tends to be a lot of fluctuation year to year based on any major breach events that happen. You know, if there's a major, you know, payment processor breach, obviously you're going to see more, you know, payment records involved in the total data set. But, the payment data is always going to have value. And to your point, the account credentials are going to have increasing value as well because, you know, it's a point I've made in the past. If why hack into a company if you can just log in? And more times than not, you know, serious attacks happen because someone logs in and it's not recognized as an attack.
Yeah. So this kind of leads into the recommendations. And we wrote three stories, but this story got the least amount of attention from our readers, and that was the DBIR recommendations. And it really gets down to the security basics. We hear it time and time again. Companies aren't manning their logs, and one of the recommendations was, you need to man your logs. And they're using poor password management practices. Only 8% of breaches in the Verizon 2012 DBIR were discovered internally. Why aren't organizations getting somebody to take a look at their logs, doing real log management rather than just setting a SIM system and walking away?
Oh, it's hard to do. Let's not overlook that. I don't want to make it seem like it's a trivial task to put that kind of monitoring in place, because not only are you talking about complicated technology, especially in the case of you know, really advanced platforms like a SIM platform, I mean, those implementations, even though the products have gotten better, those implementations still take months and years to fully implement. Plus, you need to have the staff that knows how to manage those systems. You know, configuration and ongoing alerting and change management is an issue, and you need to know really what to look for. The policies can only tell you so much. You need to be able to look at your data sets over time and figure out what an abnormality is, so you can spot those anomalies when they happen. So it's easy for us to say that companies need to, you know, do a better job of monitoring, but it's an incredibly hard task, and it takes a lot of time and a lot of effort and a lot of money and manpower, and many companies just they don't have the money at all, or it's a challenge within their organizations to justify anything security related. So just keeping the status quo is hard enough. So it's a major challenge that we can't overstate.
Mike, you did some reporting on this on, you know, security information management systems, and I know Search Security has done a lot on security information management systems. I know there's a security school that's available for our readers, and we did a special series, news series. Have SIM systems gotten easier to deploy and manage? Is it still, you know, difficult
they're
thing?
They're not. And okay. It's funny, the article that I wrote for the
As Eric described, I should say.
Exactly. As the article that I wrote for the series that you're talking about, the gist of it was about real-time analysis and how difficult it is for SIM and log management. Technology just isn't there. But one of the experts that I interviewed, we got into a discussion about rule writing for SIM and for log management and how difficult it is. And the problem is that these things are all based on thresholds, and you're constantly tweaking that threshold. And if you set it too high, you get too many alerts, you start to ignore them. You set it too low, you don't get enough alerts, and something's going to slip through. So finding that right balance and understanding, you know, what normal traffic is today and writing those thresholds according to that, your traffic changes tomorrow, changes next month, changes next year, and that whole, it's a constant tweaking of those rules, and it's really difficult. And that's, I think, where the biggest difficulty lies with these technologies.
Yeah, I found it very interesting. I also did a story for the report. I was surprised to hear that some CISOs are actually considering ripping out their first-generation SIM systems because they were so tedious to maintain and manage and deploy. Took them years. and they're looking at something that may be easier to deploy out of the box.
Yeah, and I'm surprised you got those admissions, to be honest, because that's a big nut to swallow. I mean, these things are really expensive, and to kind of, you know, admit defeat on that level is pretty impressive. And just to go back to that original data point, you said the 8% of attacks were discovered internally, only 8%. It's kind of nice to have that data. I mean, we've always heard anecdotally that companies don't hear about something happening until the FBI comes knocking on the door. And, you know, chances are that is the first time you hear about it is from a customer or from law enforcement. And they come, hey, you got a serious problem here. And, you know, now you've got a number attached to it.
What was the other technology that was very important that you kind of latched on to, Eric? Was it the remote?
Yeah, I wrote my column last month about the takeaways with remote access issues. Verizon found that last year remote access services were involved in 88% of all hacking breaches in its data set. And then of all the reported incidents involving malware last year, compromised remote access paved the way for infections 95% of the time. So 19 out of every 20, we're talking about, you know, a remote access vector, be it, you know, a protocol like VNC or RDP or, you know, a service like Dropbox or a PC Anywhere or, you know, even a core application like a VPN or webmail or something of that nature, where just going back to that theme of just, you know, either logging in or compromising that kind of access system paves the way for all manner of bad things. So it's a major, you know, low-hanging fruit issue that companies need to look at. And if, you know, what's nice about the DBIR is that ideally for most enterprises with all these issues, it's a conversation starter. Mm-hmm. It's a way to go to, you know, your CIO and other decision makers and say, hey, you know, this is the most important report that comes out in security every year. And they're saying, you know, remote access is a serious problem. Let's take the opportunity to assess our remote access posture and, you know, maybe take action if we need to. That's a good thing.
Or at a minimum, change that default password on your remote right. access that's sitting on the internet.
So we talked about the recommendations in the DBIR, and that kind of leads into our next discussion. I was at InfoSec World Conference and Expo earlier this month, and there was a panel discussion that included Marcus Rainham, Chris Nickerson, and Alex Hutton. And I'm not sure they really need any... I need to explain who these people are. These are security luminaries. They constantly are on the speaking circuit. And I went into this panel discussion as a reporter thinking that this would be kind of infotainment because I knew these guys have major opinions and are not afraid to just speak their mind. They had a great message, and their message was that CISOs can't keep spending money on big box security appliances, can't keep automating. These huge security platforms aren't really working to a certain extent. But the message got lost in this panel discussion with the way it was delivered. In my opinion, they were kind of speaking down to the folks in the audience. And these were CISOs, these were IT security directors at mid-market firms. So there was a huge range of people in the audience from small businesses where these guys had a very limited IT team, if anybody, to organizations that had a slightly larger IT team with a little more funding. And I think that that my feeling leaving there were reflected in the feedback forms that were sent to that. Some of these guys, Alex Hutton tweeted one of them, actually. It was very terse.
It's an all-time classic.
Yes, and it cannot be repeated on this show because this were a family program. Mike, I think you had something really interesting to say about these guys. They're industry luminaries, but they really haven't been spending a lot of time in the trenches, have they?
Not for a long time, probably. I mean, you've got three very strong personalities, first of all, and I wasn't there and I haven't heard a recording of it or anything, but I would assume that they were pretty much spreading the same message on that panel. You know, it's interesting. I wrote a blog post on this too. It's strictly my opinion, but if you run security for any size company, and for example, compliance is your, you know, if you have to be SOX compliant, guess what your job is every day? It's to make sure that you're SOX compliant. Yeah, sure. It's nice to be able to want to rip and replace everything that doesn't work. Get rid of those antivirus and firewalls that are signature based that just doesn't, you know, just don't adapt to everyday attacks. But you're not going to go into your boss's office and start bashing his desk with your shoe and demanding that they rip out stuff that they've invested in for 10 years and is so entrenched that a rip and replace would be just a disaster for, you know, months. It just set a company back. I mean, that's the reality these guys are facing. They have to maintain the status quo to an extent. And, you know, these guys, you know, they sit in an ivory tower, and chances are that they haven't had a CISO title in a long time. And, you know, maybe they forget. I don't know. But maybe they get caught up in their own personality.
This illustrates what you're saying. And I'm paraphrasing this back and forth, but somebody got up and asked the question, you know, hey, look, I have a limited budget. I've only got, I don't really have an IT team. And one of the people on the panel, I don't remember who it was, but they said, well, who's back in the office then mining your network? And everybody started laughing. And
that's productive, isn't it?
And the guys and the security pro came back and said, well, I do have another staff member, one other IT guy who's back there. But he asked the question, how do I go to my executive staff and communicate to them that I need two, maybe three more warm bodies on my staff to manage these systems, to take care of my SIM system. How do I do it? And, you know, it might have been Alex, it might have been Chris, you know, they said, yeah, I feel your pain, it's not easy. And then Marcus Ranum spoke up and said, I just go in there and I tell him this is what it's got to be. This is how you have to do it. Well, how can you do that?
He can. He's Marcus Ranum.
If you're not Marcus Ranum, right?
Right.
I'm not sure that IT Pro said anything else. I think he may have just walked away from the microphone and they went on to somebody else. But there's the frustration factor growing. I think people said, well, wait a second. That's not going to work for me.
Yeah, I mean, we're really quick to bash victims over the head in this particular industry, and it's not fair.
I wanted to get up there. I didn't because I think it's kind of unprofessional, especially if I'm writing a story about it. But I wanted to get up there and tell those guys to shut the F up and then explain that your message is totally on par. I agree with you 100%, and I don't think there's anybody in this audience that disagrees with you that we need to have more
ideally,
bodies.
It's the right way to go.
That automation is not working at this point. But the way you're delivering your message is just, it's insulting. It was insulting to me, and I'm not even an IT pro. Any thoughts, Eric? You've been quiet throughout this entire discussion.
I could argue both sides of the coin here, but for the sake of discussion, I'll try to come to the defense of Marcus Ranum.
Always taking the easy path. Let's defend the security luminaries.
Oh, I don't think that's an easy path in this case, because I agree with what both of you said. I don't think their message was easy to describe, but the way I'll respond, and anyone who takes offense politically might want to skip the next 60 seconds, but doesn't it reflect what's wrong with our society today if presenters like these guys, who are admittedly big names in the industry, they do have a lot of cachet, and I certainly listen very closely to whatever they have to say. Obviously, their approach was kind of the shock and awe. You know, they were trying to get people's attention by delivering an aggressive message. But what's wrong with our society if we can't understand that and take in the message and filter out the approach? Why is it that we all have to be coddled? We all have to get the message in just the right way. Oh, you're still special and wonderful, but, you know, you might want to think about changing just a couple things. No, you're doing a lot of things wrong. Suck it up and deal with it. These guys are right. You know, you don't necessarily have to have, you know, everything spoon-fed to you. And that's not the way life works. And that's not the way security works. Sometimes when an attack happens, you're going to get kicked in the teeth. And you got to get ready for that. And these guys, you know, maybe the people in the audience just weren't ready for that. So that would be my response. I see both sides of it. But at the same time, I think that the idea was to get people's attention with the way they delivered the message. And to their credit, they did.
I'm going to go find all my youth soccer trophies and box them up and give them back.
It's a lot more complicated than that. I mean, it's not just, you know, it's not about hand-holding somebody or coddling them. It's about going into a session thinking you're going to learn something when, in fact, it really was meant for an entertainment factor. And I think some of the people in the audience may have taken it like, I mean, they've spent good money to be there, and I think maybe they thought this would be a good learning experience for them, when in fact they were just insulted to a certain extent.
So isn't it the conference's fault for not positioning the session the right way?
Possibly, and I felt as though they had too many of these guys on stage. They all had the same message, so why is it helpful to have three panelists that are all going to say the same thing? It would have been helpful to have somebody speaking from the other side. You know, who would be a good person to balance them off? I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, one of the best panels I ever saw was on vulnerability disclosure at RSA, and they had H.D. Moore and a couple other, you know, the usual suspects on disclosure, and they had a customer. They had a CISO from, I think it was Continental Airlines or United or something, and you know, he back and forth, we're talking about our relationships with the research community and all this crap. And the guy stood up, he goes, you know what? I don't care about your problems. I'm the customer. Fix the problem and give me my patch and give me my fix and give me my secure software. And finally, somebody was speaking for, you know, for the user in that discussion. Mm-hmm. You never heard it. And you're exactly right. So these guys all had the same message, and you needed a reality check, some kind of descending voice there.
We didn't have a CISO there. We didn't have somebody who's in the trenches and has to go to the executive board sitting on that panel saying, wait a second, guy, I hear what you're saying. I agree with you, but it's not that easy.
Yeah, this was InfoSec World, right? Ultimately, they were, I'm sure, happy with the outcome because they got a ton of buzz about it. But I'd be curious to know from them how much it worked out to be like what they intended.
I felt slightly bad, and I haven't had a chance to talk to him. I believe it was Eric Maywald of Gartner who was the moderator of the panel, but you can tell from the start of the panel that, you know, he wasn't really going to have a leash at all on any of these guys, and whatever he attempted to ask some pretty pointed questions, saying, "Wait a second, what about this?" But it really didn't go anywhere. That does it for this edition of Security Squad. You can check out the latest news and information at our news page at searchsecurity.com/news. And be sure to take a look at our refreshed homepage at searchsecurity.com. For Eric Parizeau and Mike Momoso, I'm Rob Westervelt. Have a great day.